Welcome, everybody, to the Third and Gold podcast presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Tyler James, and I'm joined, as always, by the one and only Eric Hansen. Together, we cover Notre Dame football, recruiting, and more for blueandgold.com on the On3 network. Notre Dame continued its winning streak last weekend with a 37-15 victory at Pitt. The Irish remain at number 9 in the college football playoff rankings as they prepare to host Syracuse on Saturday. Saturday is also Senior Day, which means it could be the last game in Notre Dame Stadium for a number of Irish players. It could also be the last time a Notre Dame Stadium crowd gets to see running backs Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price playing together. So what better time to talk to one of the best running backs in Notre Dame history? Allen Pinkett still holds the Notre Dame career record for rushing attempts with 889. He's second in career rushing yards with 4,131 and still holds the career rushing touchdowns record with 49. Allen, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. And, you know, I played long enough ago that I'm the second leading rusher because when we played, they didn't count the bowl game statistics. So I played in two bowl games, had over 100 in each and scored some touchdowns in each. So, you know, maybe second leading rusher with an asterisk.
Allen, to start, what have you enjoyed about Notre Dame season this year? What have you liked about the way this has played out for the Irish?
You know, I think this team plays to the personality of Marcus Freeman. I think that, you know, he wills them to win. He gives them great direction. You know, I look at him as a great life coach, not just a great football coach. And they're getting life lessons on the field, you know, like perseverance and diligence and, you know, all those qualities we want young men to have. And, you know, since I'm on him, it's amazing that the coach before him, and he wasn't the only one, complained about the academic standards at Notre Dame. A lot of coaches like to use it as an excuse, but Marcus embraces it. And says, well, hell yeah, I want smart guys. And I can tell you from being in the NFL, I was coming from Notre Dame. I wasn't the smartest guy in the room, but I wasn't the dumbest guy in the room. I was somewhere in the middle. But smart guys, what they do, they want to go someplace where they can win. So all these schools you think are football factories has some geniuses on them because they want to go someplace where they can enjoy victories. And so now it only makes sense, you know, with Notre Dame talking about it not being just a four-year plan, it's a 40-year plan, to grab those guys that understand that it's a cerebral game now, and this is more than just a four-year commitment, to embrace that and get those guys, and all it does is improve your football team.
I love what you said about that, Allen, because – Marcus talks about choosing hard and the bumpy road to better. And, you know, like my son, who's in his 30s, just started a business and, you know, it's not all right turns and green lights. And I share some of what Marcus says to him. I'm wondering, when you were a player, what was the hardest part about the Notre Dame experience for you? Was it in the classroom? Was it balancing everything? Was it the football? Was it the football coach you had? What was the hardest part?
I guess the hardest part was the off season, because I was so regimented during the season. If I had an hour on Tuesday that I wasn't going to have on Wednesday, I used it. And I'm just one of those guys, when I'm busier, I just do better. So like the schoolwork and things didn't bother me, because when I was in high school, I had a track coach where we got home at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and then I had to start my homework. So when I got to college, you know, nothing changed. You know, doing the homework thing wasn't bad. And I actually did better academically during the season than I did in the off season. Cause in the off season, I would say, oh, I got so much time and I'll get to it. And then that's where the procrastination comes in. You know, it was good because my schedule was regimented, you know, and every hour was spoken for. And I think I thrive in conditions like that. It's just, you know, when I got out of football and having to make my own schedule, that's been the challenge.
Alan, I think one of the guys who exemplifies Notre Dame's ability to recruit top athletes and guys that are curious and want to challenge themselves is Jeremiah Love, who's shown it on the football field, how special he is. What stands out to you from a running back perspective that makes him such a special player?
Oh my God, there's so many accolades, but you know, I can tell you, if we just go back to that particular run in the Pitt game where he spun on the guy, I mean, he has now confounded every defense that he's going to play. Because you think about a defender, you know, am I going to rush up to him and try and tackle him? Hell no, because he's going to spin on me and make me look silly. Well, do I, you know, chop my feet and try and get balanced? Can't do that either, because he's strong enough to run over me. You know, so he has put the defense in a bind with that last run that he made. I just like that, you know, he has a combination of explosiveness / acceleration that's unequal to anybody else. And when he gets in the open field, you're not catching him, you know, because he is a sprinter. You get to see that sprinter stride when he gets out in the open. But I think what he's done is he's solidified his opportunity to have a chance to play on Sunday by his play this year, just watching him pass block, you know. And there are some of those coaches that say, no block, no rock, you know. If you don't block, you're not going to get the ball. But he has done an excellent job. And then I also, his ability to catch the pass, and I guess it was the Texas A&M game? He had a one-handed grab that ended up taking in for a touchdown. You know, so his stock is way, way up. You know, the thing I hope is that he's able to stay healthy. I don't mean to jinx him by saying that. But he is the complete package. And, you know, there were a couple of games, you know, you get in the middle of the season and you think you're supposed to be getting 100 yards easy, and it's not easy, and you start to press a little bit. And I want to say, I guess in the Miami game and in the NC State game, he was trying to, you know, force it up into a crease. But after that, he's become sort of like a Le'Veon Bell, where he is able to pause just long enough for the hole to open, and then he can step on the gas and get through the hole. So he's become a lot more patient, a lot more patient runner this year by letting the play develop in front of him so we can see all of his talents once he gets up in the hole.
Alan, I'm going to follow up on that, your thought there. I get people that ask me all the time, and I think I know what you're going to say, but Notre Dame runs inside the tackles a lot with him. They don't run a lot of sweeps with him. It seems like if there is a sweep, it's kind of his improv. But I wonder what's the advantage with a guy with that skill set to run it inside more than you run him on the perimeter?
Well, I think, believe it or not, there's less traffic. Because if you can outflank, you know, some of the defense, I know that, you know, the defense likes to bring safeties up or outside linebackers, and they can crash, you know, from the outside and stop you in the backfield. Since he's running out of the gun, it ends up being a shorter distance going through the middle because he can hit it so fast that those outside rushers can't get to him. But, you know, I used to get that question. It's like, you know, why are they running my small ass up the middle? Trust me, that's the shortest distance. If you can break to the, you know, if you break that initial level of the defense, usually you just got one guy you got to make miss, and after that you're playing with the safeties, you know. So it's a lot of people think you got to be big and burly to go, you know, to the interior line, you know, between tackle and tackle, but you don't. You can incorporate speed and agility right there, because you got actually less people to make miss.
Alan, you were talking about sort of the bind that Jeremiah Love puts defenders in when they're getting ready to tackle him. Part of that too, I think, is his ability to hurdle guys. And now I think there's mixed opinions on how often he does that and if he's putting himself in danger. What are your thoughts on that as sort of a, it's almost like an evolution of the running back position, that that has become an asset for certain guys like Jeremiah Love who are capable of doing that?
Well, I think he's done his homework. And a lot of times when you're, and what I mean by doing his homework, I think he's done it in his head. I think he's practiced his moves in his head, and he knows certain defenders are not going to try and tackle him high, you know, because they'll get run over. And those are the ones, sometimes when you're running and you get up on them so quickly, you can see them already starting to go down. And that's when that triggers that thing in his mind to say, I'm jumping over this dude, you know. But usually when you go airborne, it slows you down. But in his case, it doesn't, because he comes right back down on his feet in stride, you know, able to run again. And when he comes back down, he might run over your ass, you know, after he got done leaping somebody. So just all the skill sets that he has in his back pocket to run the ball, I think scares the hell out of a defense.
You know, I was going through I was actually writing something up today on some of the awards, and he's a semifinalist for the Doak Walker. And I was shocked that it might be the oldest award individual that they have, and Notre Dame has never won that. And I think Reggie Brooks is the only finalist. That surprises me. And it made me wonder to ask you, since you've seen a lot of running backs before and after you at Notre Dame, where would Jeremiah Love stack up in that group?
Well, up till now, my favorite running back at Notre Dame was Lee Becton, because, you know, he fake you out in the phone booth. I mean, he would make anybody miss in a tight space. And I just loved his style. But we've had a number of great running backs, but I don't think we've had a back like Jeremiah Love. When I think back over all the running backs that Notre Dame has had, and there's been a lot of them, you know, that have been the complete package that he has. And I also heard that, you know, for all the supposedly great running backs Notre Dame has had, the last first round pick was Jerome Bettis. And how many years do we have to go back to know, you know, and there's been a lot of good backs in between Jerome Bettis and Jeremiah Love, but I think he will leave that school being the best running back that has ever worn the jersey. And he's almost at a point now that when he gets the ball, it reminds me of Rocket, you know, because when Rocket would get the ball, you always held your breath because you knew he was going to make some kind of explosive, mind-blowing play. And I think Jeremiah Love has gotten into that category.
Alan, it seems like an embarrassment of riches for Notre Dame when you also have Jadarian Price available as a running back behind Jeremiah Love. Obviously, their talents matter, but how important is the unselfishness that those two have in sort of accepting their roles and being willing to share time in the way that allows both of them to excel in the way that they have?
Well, I think because the ultimate goal is to win, and when you win, everybody eats. And what I mean by everybody eating, you know, Jadarian is going to get very good looks too. And to Jadarian and Jeremiah's benefit, since they're splitting carries, not as much wear and tear, could increase their livelihood, could increase their longevity playing in the NFL. Because if you look at the NFL, a typical, you know, starting running back has a shelf life of about 6 years. You know, if you're running it all the time and you get hit all the time, it's about 6 years. Now, some of that is starting to change because of RPOs and spreading everything out and catching passes. But, you know, I look at a guy like Ashton Jeanty, who ran the ball, over 300 times last year. And you can, to me, with my eyes, it looks like he's had, you know, a decent amount of wear and tear. I don't know how long he's going to last, but I look at a Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price that look fresh when they run the ball. And I think their careers can be a lot longer. So it's number one goal is you win. All these awards come as a result of winning. And, you know, when you win, there's more attention focused on you. And somehow the NFL believes that if you were back there and running and you guys were winning, you must be better than those guys that were on teams that were losing. Yeah, so it's going to give them more opportunity to show their talent.
Alan,
by the way, there was no way I was going to get a Doak Walker Award because the year I was playing, Bo Jackson
took Who's that? Yeah. That's cool. I do think your 889 career carries, we can just take a chisel and put that in stone because that's not going anywhere. I don't think that'll ever be broken. But talking about carries and wear and tear and so forth, I think Jadarian has a decision to make. I think Notre Dame will throw a lot of money at him to try to get him to ponder coming back for another year. If you were advising him, what would that conversation be like in terms of, okay, you'd be the number one back, but you're going to take some more pounding. What would you advise him?
I think I would, number one, get a projection of where he could go right now in the NFL, you know, because you only got so many shots in your body. You might as well get paid for them. Now that it's different now because of the NIL, he can get some money now.
Right.
I think a lot of it is, are you ready for that next challenge? Do you want that next challenge of having to go against the best players week in, week out? If you don't think you're ready for that, it wouldn't be a bad idea to come back and have one more year. Because let me tell you, you think this team is good now? Next year with CJ Carr? Oh, my God. All right. When they made CJ the starter, I wasn't so excited this year, and he is ahead of schedule, I'll have to say. But next year, that's a backfield you want to be in because, you know, they're not going to say we're stopping the run. So you're going to have some running lanes, you know, to run through. I would just, you know, for Jadarian, number one, get advice. He probably has an agent. You know, you can also counsel the NFL just to figure out, you know, to if you want to enter the draft or not. And I used to say to kids, you don't want to leave early to go late. Meaning you don't want to get out of school early to be drafted in the fifth round. But I think the last guy I said that about was Justin Tuck. Because he left early. You don't want to leave early to go late. But I guess he made the right decision.
Alan, what is your level of concern as it relates to Jadarian with his fumbling issues that he's had of late? How do you correct that? Do you think that is a long-term concern for him?
No, I think what has to happen is – when I look at his fumbles, they are a result of trying to gain a few more yards to fight through a tackle. And one of the things I did, you know, because I fumbled a couple of times, that is as soon as I felt a hand on the ball, I went down. You take away the possibility of fumbling if, you know, because you can feel where their hands are when they're tackling you and everything. There's also the knowledge that if the hand hits the ball correctly or a helmet hits the ball, I don't care if you have crazy glue on, ball's coming out. All right. But if you can feel them get their hand on the ball, just get down on the ground right now. And I think if he does that, you know, because the last thing you want to be doing is worried about fumbling the ball when you're running the ball. You know, and I think about a guy like Tiki Barber, who he sort of just, he went to that high and tight model, you know, which he looked silly running it, but he didn't fumble anymore. So I guess it wasn't so silly. You know, maybe you adopt a technique of holding it closer to your body and high and tight. Now, understand when you do that, it's going to slow you down a little bit. But I guess if you end up with the ball when the whistle is blown, then it was successful. But I would just say, you feel your hand on the ball, get down on the ground.
Alan, short yardage and goal line has been a bugaboo for this Notre Dame team, given everything else they're really good at on offense. When you are talking to your TV and suggesting plays to Marcus through the TV, what are you telling him to do on short yardage that they're not doing now?
Well, I think they heard me. They took that little wildcat formation and put it on the shelf, you know, because they never did figure out how to block that thing. No more of that. You know, I had not just goal line, but, you know, fourth down, fourth and one, that type of thing. Mal Moore was my running back coach at Notre Dame, and he used to always say fourth down is about pride and want to. Now, sometimes the other team has pride and want to also. But I think when you get close to the goal line, that's where you really have to force your manhood on other teams. That's where you really have to have that flat back and say we're stronger than you and we're better than you. And you try to run it down their throat, because that's what breaks a defense heart more than anything else. I think in the Pitt game on the fourth down where they tried to throw it to Eli, I think they're trying to get him his touchdown. They knew that if they didn't make it there, Pitt wasn't going to go 99 yards and score on them. But it's been a problem in the red zone. And I think the more success they have running it down there is going to open up all the different passes that they throw. And I like play action down there, but I don't necessarily like play action in a horizontal sense where you're trying to run sideways. I like play action where you're going vertical. You know, we haven't seen it where they fake a run, tight end slips over the middle, and you hit the guy in the back of the end zone. We haven't seen that. And there's other plays you can derive off of that, but I know that's something that they are consistently working on and, you know, should see improvement. But it all starts with, man, you just got to be a beast down there when you run the ball. You got to run with a different mentality, you know, because you get in the red zone, it's payoff time. You know, that's time to get some points and put this opponent away.
Alan, we've talked a lot about the pro potential of Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price. I'm curious, what was the most difficult part of the transition to the NFL for yourself?
I think it's always the speed of the game. Everything happens a lot faster. I don't care what these guys look like in their uniform or in a pair of shorts. They can all run. And, you know, in college, you know, you might be able to run over the right side, then come all the way back across the field to the left side, then cut again, run all the way back to the right side. In the NFL, can't do that. They take this thing that's called pursuit angles, all right? And it's not uncommon for a 300-pound defensive tackle to hit you in the ear hole 10 yards downfield. So you got to be concerned with getting upfield. And I can remember in my mind the second I felt like I became a pro. And it was all getting adjusted to the speed of the game, the speed I needed to get through the hole, you know, the ability to speed up the read and anticipate. But it, like I say, the speed of the game is always the thing. Once you get that and the game slows down, oh, man, you're going to be dangerous.
Alan, before we let you go, I do want to catch up on everything you're doing right now, but I have one more football question for you. And that's the defense. This defense has improved incredibly since the Purdue game. And I'm wondering what you're seeing that you feel like this could be sustainable if Notre Dame makes the playoff and starts playing some elite offenses like USC's again?
Well, you know, I at first I thought our defense was bad when I saw all those receivers from A&M, you know, torching us. But then turns out they were doing that to everybody. but I think after those first two games, I think Marcus addressed it, that he needed to have a talk, because what was happening is, you know, one level of the defense wasn't complementing another level. And, you know, I think that when he came out and said, do your job, I think that meant if we're telling you to clog the B gap, don't be running outside to the C gap. Stay in the B gap. If we're asking you in the defensive backfield to maintain inside leverage, don't be guessing and you know, try to make a hero play. If, you know, every position is dependent upon another on defense. And I think once they started believing that, because they were told, do their job, once they started believing that and then saw the results, then they started to gain more confidence. And right now, shoot, there's not a team out there that I'm afraid of. So I don't care where they put Notre Dame in the playoffs. I don't care who they play. I don't care where they have to go to play. Notre Dame has a defense and an offense that will travel.
Yeah, continuing with that, Alan, you mentioned earlier that maybe the ceiling would be higher next season. The thought would be maybe the ceiling would be higher next season because CJ Carr would have a year under his belt, but they're also ahead of schedule. What do you think are fair expectations for Notre Dame in a potential college football playoff this season?
I think they can go all the way to the national championship. I honestly do. Because, and I feel bad for the committee because they got to do all these metrics and things like that. Your eyes don't lie. When you watch this team play, you know they're one of the best 12 teams in the country. Now, what they can't do is make mistakes and beat themselves. But when they're on, this team is like a machine, both on offense and defense. And I think this year they've been relatively healthier than they were last year. Even though we've got three new offensive linemen playing right now. But last year, I think it was pretty similar. But I think Notre Dame is more stout on the defensive line this year, has more depth on the defensive line than they did last year. So as long as Notre Dame can stay healthy and the quality depth that they have, they can make a run for this thing.
All right. Well, Alan, I know that you got still a lot of things going, even though you're quote unquote retired. So give us what you're up to in life and what you're up to with regard to football.
Well, I got to tell you, I've contemplated retirement, but there's not enough golf I can play that'll satisfy me. Plus, I live in Indiana, so that you know, the weather shuts me down. But you know, I told you I do better when I'm busy. My day job is I work for a company called Local IQ. Local IQ is the digital marketing arm for the USA Today. And the USA Today owns the South Bend Tribune. You know, I do marketing for Local IQ in the automotive space. I help automobile dealers with some of their digital advertising. Cool. Other than that, I do two podcasts. One is called the Irish Squad Show, which we do every Thursday night and post game. And I do that with Reggie Brooks and Allison Hayes and another Notre Dame graduate, Tyler Wojak, who's out in California. And then I do a podcast for the Colts. Of course, I tell the Colts I'm the good luck charm. That's why they're doing so good this year. You know, but I don't think they believe me. I do the Colts twice a week also. And I mean, I get paid a little bit to do that. But I enjoy doing it. I enjoy, you know, because after I got done broadcasting, it's like I had 1,000 stories and nobody to share them with, you know. So this type of deal gives me the outlet to run my mouth, which you can see I can do, and, you know, get some things off my chest or just express my opinion. And so those are the things I'm doing, as well as raising a teenager right now. I've got 2 older kids and a grandchild, but I've also got a 14-year-old in this house, and she's the reason for my gray hair.
Well, I got a whole bunch of reasons for mine too. So, and I got 8 grandkids now, and they are trying to restore all the black that's still left in the hair, but there's none left. But you can share stories with us anytime, because we really enjoyed it, and we really appreciate you coming on with us today.
Well, thank you. You know, we go back a ways, Eric. So yeah. Always happy to help you out, and you know, always, always willing to talk about my favorite team.
Before we get back to the podcast, I wanted to share a word from our friends at Academy Sports and Outdoors. The holiday season is here, and Academy Sports and Outdoors has the legendary gifts you need at undefeatable prices every day. Shop in-store or online at academy.com to save on gifts on everybody's list, from football jerseys and basketball hoops to fire pits and deer stands. The most wonderful time of the year happens here. This Christmas, give the gift of fun from Academy Sports and Outdoors. All right, now it's time for questions. You can submit questions to us on Twitter or the Loose Emoji Board before every podcast. I'm at TJamesND and Eric's at EHansonND. First one I have for us, Eric, is from MS Domer on the Loose Emoji Board. Wouldn't it make sense to have a play package where CJ Carr goes under center, especially in short yardage situations?
Well, MS Domer, I actually peeked at your question before we had our Thursday Zoom with Marcus today, Thursday, and it inspired me to ask him. So I did ask him that question, and my Thursday takeaways column, that's the lead to it, is why Notre Dame doesn't go under center. But let me give my answer. I do think there could be some benefit for that. I know when Sam Hartman was under center, it didn't seem to work. There wasn't a big enough body there, and maybe it had something to do with who was playing center, but those plays didn't work. With Riley Leonard, I think I could have played center and they would have worked. But what Marcus Freeman said today in a nutshell was they don't practice it. And if you are going to be good at it, you have to practice it a lot. And so if they did dedicate that time to getting good at being under center, what are they taking away in practice? What are they not going to practice to get those plays in? And he did say, I think his last words were, maybe we should reconsider, or, you know, something to that effect. So I can see the benefits of it, but I do agree with him. If they're not going to practice it very often, doing it in a game, I think, is risky.
Yeah, it's only beneficial if it's something you're good at. Like, there are a lot of different ways you can do things on the football field, but if you're not good at doing them, it's not going to help you improve your chances of succeeding. It does feel a bit like a miscalculation on Notre Dame's part going into the season. Like, this would have been something that they came in the season with under center packages, and then the ability to do different things under center. And probably not a coincidence that CJ Carr is a first year starter. Like, maybe that's one less thing that he needs to worry about, is all these other plays from under center, and the footwork that's required to do that. So, like, it could help. Yes, I think there's plenty of information out there that suggests that short yardage situations are won more often by teams who do that. But also, like, the teams that run under center are good at that too. Like, they don't just, like, it's not like, for like instance, Oregon. I don't know that they probably run a lot of under center stuff either.
They don't. So I actually researched who did and who didn't, and they are one of the few one of the least likely to run something under center.
But Notre Dame can't just Notre Dame has to find a solution. If that's not its solution, it has to find its own version of a solution for short yardage situations. And doesn't necessarily seem like they have found it quite yet. I think the under center part of it has sort of been treated by fans as like a magical fix. And I don't know that it's that simple. It's not like you just line the guy up under center and all of a sudden you're going to start getting 3 yard chunks. I mean, even that quarterback sneak that Notre Dame tried to run out of the end zone did not look very good. It didn't look like something that was a successful plan moving forward for Notre Dame.
Marcus brought that up in his answer.
I like the pistol formation as sort of the in-between in terms of having the running back directly behind the quarterback and not necessarily limiting your options in terms of which way the running back can go in a direct line. But Notre Dame needs to continue to find something that works because there probably will be games that will be decided on something like that moving forward with the way Notre Dame's postseason aspirations are. All right, next question is from at Charles W. Wolf. Do we think we will see any new offensive wrinkles given a test drive before the playoffs and perhaps lower key games against Syracuse and Stanford? Also, does God not want Eli Raritan to score a touchdown this season? And Charles also added, sorry for the mild CJ Carr jinx question last week. And if you don't recall last week, Charles asked us if Carr is the best quarterback since Rick Meyer at Notre Dame.
Yeah, I will say this. I did a column on it this week. I actually thought CJ Carr proved how good he was in the Pittsburgh game. It wasn't in his statistics necessarily, but I think it showed up in everybody else's statistics in terms of what he's able to do at the line of scrimmage. At his age, it's just incredible. And I think that's what sometimes is a little bit nuanced. And, you know, maybe that's something that the TV crew needs to point out, but it's certainly something that got my attention. It got something that got Marcus Freeman's attention was how good he was at the line of scrimmage and getting Notre Dame out of a bad run look and maybe into a good pass play or vice versa. So no problem on the jinx. I don't think you jinxed him the early part. And now I forgot what the rest of the question was, but I'll have to review it here.
The offensive wrinkles. Do you think we'll see any new offensive wrinkles before the playoffs?
So for me, you're playing against two defenses that aren't necessarily very good. In fact, they're two of the worst defenses in the country, not just on Notre Dame's schedule. The one thing is with Stanford, they do have a good run defense. That's the one thing that they do well. But Syracuse is bad against the pass, bad against the run. I don't know what you would get out of it that you wouldn't have gotten out of using it at other times or that you couldn't do against your own defense in practice. If you want to go ones versus ones, they're, you know, comparable defensively to what you're going to face in a playoff team. I guess if you wanted to put something on tape, you wanted somebody to practice and you just wanted to mess with them, I guess you could do that. But at this point, I just take care of my business. You know, I mean, it's not like these teams are going to show up and lie on the ground. You're still going to have to earn these victories and improve as a team. And I think you want to give your best effort and run your best plays.
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity to do some of that, but I don't think it would be like vastly different things. Like, and it's hard to know, like, what are you actually learning against bad defenses? Like, if you run some more two back sets that didn't work earlier in the season and they have success against Syracuse and Stanford, does that mean anything? Or is that just like, is the data you get from how successful or unsuccessful it is, does that hold up against the teams you'll eventually be playing if you win both those games? Obviously, Notre Dame needs to continue to improve its short yardage efficiency. And so if its plan moving forward is to do other things, then I think they need to do those presented with those situations. But there's always different wrinkles that Notre Dame can add to its offense. I'm not sure that especially if it's something that you feel like you can use moving forward. I don't know that you would want to put it on tape unless you feel like it's something that it's almost like deceiving them. Like, here, we're going to run some two back sets and then actually not even, you know, prepare for it, but we're not actually going to use it when it comes time to, to play you in the playoffs. So I'm not sure what the balance of that will be for Notre Dame. And as Charles said, Notre Dame sure as heck tried to get Raritan a touchdown last week, but it just wasn't meant to be. He had a couple opportunities and wasn't able to still get his first touchdown, but I imagine it's coming soon. All right, next question is from Headless on the Loose Emoji Board. You're the coach from a team in the playoffs, not Notre Dame. In order, which five teams would you least want to face in your playoff matchup?
So I did a story on this from Notre Dame's standpoint, and I specifically looked at Notre Dame's strengths and weaknesses. So we want five of these. I thought it was three.
I wrote down, I have five, at least in the question.
Okay, gotcha. I
must can go have first down. If you want more time.
Why don't you go first? I'll say what mine were, and then I can do a generic list, I guess.
Yeah, I think the reason the question was phrased the way it was is so we could fit Notre Dame into that list, potentially, if we felt like Notre Dame should belong in that list. My response to the hypothetical is, like, I feel like I need to know the identity of my team to know the actual answer to the question, right? Like, am I good at running the football? Am I good at passing? But for the sake of this, I'll just – so essentially I'm just, like, power ranking these teams more than anything. Number one is Ohio State to me, defending champs. I don't know that there's real obvious weaknesses there with the Buckeyes. Number two is Georgia to me. I think the combination of talent and coaching with the Bulldogs is something that I don't want to play against as a coach. I know I even said that last year going into the playoffs, and Notre Dame was able to win that game. But I just think that there's a lot to deal with when you're playing against Georgia and a team that knows how to play on a big stage like that. And I think that stuff matters. Third, I would put Notre Dame. I think the talent, coaching, experience equation is all good for the Irish right now, and the way they're playing as of late is a positive. Fourth, I would have Indiana. I think they're really hot right now. I still have some questions about exactly how good Indiana is, but I think their coaching is great. I think that's a team that's continues to build confidence and obviously has some experience from its run last season. And then fifth, I put Texas A&M. I was a bit of a toss-up from my perspective in terms of Texas A&M and Oregon. But I gave Texas A&M the nod.
Okay. So in my story, I did it from Notre Dame's perspective. So since the story is almost a week old, I'll share who I had the top five Notre Dame wouldn't want to face. And then I'll do a more generic list based on Notre Dame's strengths and weaknesses. It was Ohio State 1, Indiana 2, Oregon 3, which surprised me. But when you dig into the numbers, Texas A&M 4 and Georgia 5. And Texas Tech to me was a team that really looked good with its numbers, but I don't know how good the Big 12 is. And that's why I put them as a mystery team. But I know Tyler and I talked last year and I kept saying, you know what? I think Notre Dame matches up pretty good against Georgia. And Tyler looked at me like I was from Mars. And I would have too had I not dug into the numbers. And I even had trouble saying it, even knowing what the numbers were. If I'm doing this generically, I would still put Ohio State at the top, and I would still put Indiana next. They've got a little bit of playoff experience and they've played enough big games where I'm convinced that they're for real. And I would put Notre Dame third on that list because of their balance. I'd put Georgia fourth, and then fifth, it'd be between Texas A&M and Texas Tech. And I would go with A&M just because I still think their numbers aren't great, but I think they're more tested than Texas Tech is. And I just think they would be a big game team. And they played a big chunk of this last part of the stretch of their games without Le'Veon Moss, who I think is a really good running back. And they're going to be getting him back here soon. And I do think he'd make a difference in some of these playoff matchups.
Following up on that, I think you had Oregon higher on your versus Notre Dame list. What's the difference you feel in terms of why they would match up well against Notre Dame versus maybe a generic team?
I think they are the number one pass efficiency defense in the country. They're the number three defense in the country. Some of the things they do on offense, I think, would give Notre Dame the most problems. They've got a quarterback that's not a statue. And they also are, they run a lot more than they pass. But when they pass, they're right behind Notre Dame. Notre Dame's third and Oregon's fourth in pass efficiency. So I think they do a lot of good things well. But I don't know how well they would stand up in a playoff run. I'm not sure that they've proven that. They almost choked against Penn State in a big road game. And then Indiana beat them by double digits at home. That's what concerns me about Oregon. Usually Oregon has an ambitious conference schedule. You know, it's usually harder, and they usually test themselves more out of conference. They didn't this year. They played as easy of a non-conference schedule as you could get, which is really unusual for them. And so that's where Oregon doesn't make my top five. I mean, I think you made a really good point about Kirby Smart in Georgia. They have confidence. They have swagger. They've been there before. The stage is not going to be too big for them. If they're going to get beat, it's going to be because the other team is better, not because they wet down their leg.
All right. Our next question is from N_D_Betts. Tinfoil hat time. Did Pat Narduzzi intentionally try to discredit Notre Dame's win against Pitt with his pregame comments about losing by 100? Hear me out. Miami plays Pitt to end their regular season. Let's say it's a hard-fought close game, but Miami squeaks out a W. ND's win obviously would make look a lot better against Pitt since they blew them out, but if Narduzzi made the committee think that Pitt didn't give their best against Notre Dame, then that may give Miami more of an edge. Could this have been a conscious attempt to get more ACC teams in the college football playoff?
All I can say is I want to party with you.
Yeah, I think it's a little far-fetched from my perspective. I don't.
That can't be a serious question.
I think there is some validity to people wondering about, because there's just been so much of a push from the ACC to essentially discredit Notre Dame compared to Miami, that folks wonder, like, what's going on with some of these things. I don't think Pat Narduzzi is some sort of genius with that kind of foresight. I also, what matters the most, I don't think Pat Narduzzi's comments were reflective of how they approached the game on the field. Like, if Pitt wasn't trying its best, like, Desmond Reed wouldn't have played. He's dealt with injuries. He got hurt in the game. That wouldn't have played. He wouldn't have played that game. Same with the linebackers, Rasheem Biles and Kyle Lewis. If Pitt wasn't trying to win the game, those guys wouldn't have played against the Irish. So I think the reality of the game and Pat Narduzzi's comments didn't necessarily line up.
Here's what I'll say. If the committee listened to Pat Narduzzi's comments and factors that in, every one of them should be kicked off the committee for the rest of their lives. I think what's relevant in the Pitt Miami game, and I had somebody that has a building named after them at Notre Dame, or a college named after them at Notre Dame, text me about this, and I appreciate him pointing this out. But I mean, it's supposed to be pretty cold in Pittsburgh the weekend that Miami has to come up there. It's going to be wintry, and that is going to be interesting. Pitt may be out of it at that point. If they lose to Georgia Tech, they're out of it. But how Miami deals with the weather, they've only left the state of Florida twice this year. That'll be the second time. That's going to be very, very interesting. I think Miami defense matches up so well with Pittsburgh's offense. It's going to be hard for Pittsburgh to score any points, especially if Desmond Reed isn't available. But I'm telling you what, Pitt's defense could give Miami's offense some problems in cold weather. I think it's intriguing.
Yeah, and if Pat Narduzzi really wanted to be in on this conspiracy, he would just let Miami beat him by 100, right? And then give Miami a better
chance. And ask Pitt to put a tarp over the top of their stadium so it's not cold or snowy.
All right. A couple of questions coming up from Marie Biafore at Biafore_Marie. Are the top receiver and top running back for 2026 currently on the team, or do you think they would be coming from the portal?
I definitely think the top running backs on the team, whether it be Jadarian Price or Aeneas Williams or Nolan James or Kedron Young, I think they're on. I don't think one of the freshmen would be the leading rusher, and I don't think they'll go to the portal for a running back given all the numbers they have. For wide receiver, you would think it'd be Faison or Greathouse would be their leading receiver next year. I think that's pretty realistic. Could they go and get a boundary receiver with Micah Gilbert and Cam Williams coming up behind? Those guys don't profile as, body-wise, like Malachi Fields is. I guess if there's another one of him out there, you could look at that, and that possibly could be your leading receiver. But I would probably think Faison or Greathouse would be your leading receiver next year.
Yeah, I think it's intriguing, and I think any answer is possible here. Like, I wouldn't rule anything out. I would say that the receiver is on the team currently, with Faison as the best bet for that. But I do think Notre Dame would be smart to aid the receiver room through the portal this offseason. What that looks like, who they can get, I don't know the answer to that. Same with running back. I don't think you spend money on the portal with running back unless Notre Dame is losing a ton of its running backs. Like, maybe Aeneas Williams isn't pleased with how this season went in terms of being the third string guy and not really playing much. But I think they have enough talent in the running back room. And sort of if you approach it from the NFL perspective, a lot of NFL teams don't want to spend a lot of money on the running back position because you can sort of fill that role in different ways. But if you're going with a plan into the offseason of we're going to throw as much money at Jadarian Price as we can to get him to stay, and he still says no, do you just allot that money to another running back in the transfer portal, or do you put that money at other positions? I think that's an interesting question that Notre Dame may be confronted with this offseason. Next question is from Marie Biafore. Put a percentage on what you think your chances are, the chances are of Pitt beating Georgia Tech and Pitt beating Miami.
All right. I wrote those down. And to me, again, Desmond Reed is a huge factor in both of these. Georgia Tech is so interesting because they're the number one offense in the country from a total offense standpoint, yards per game. And they're really good in just about every offensive category. And they're really below average, not awful, but below average in every defensive category. And you look at their last two games, and NC State and Boston College have combined for 82 points against them. They lost to NC State. They barely beat Boston College. And Georgia Tech is kind of Boston College on steroids, not literally steroids, but just a better version of them. So I'm going to give Pitt a 51% chance of beating Georgia Tech and a 25.24783% chance to beat Miami.
I'm sure Marie will appreciate that specificity, Eric. Yeah, I think the Pitt-Georgia Tech game is a bit of a toss-up, too. I went 45%. I was considering 50. I don't know. And I do think, like, if Pitt beats Georgia Tech, then I think that number against Miami probably increases in Pitt's favor. They're going to have confidence going into that game. I just don't know how Pitt is going to handle Miami's defensive front. Like, what? Like, if Notre Dame did that to Pitt, like, what is Miami going to do? And so that makes me wonder, like, what how Pitt beats a Miami team, unless Miami just doesn't show up and doesn't play to its potential. And Miami hasn't had to leave the state of Florida very often this season, and maybe that leads to Miami not playing up to its potential. But I think there's a better chance that Pitt right now beats Georgia Tech than Miami. Next question is from at Jeff Burke 87. And it was more of a statement than a question. It was something we talked about during the Football Never Sleeps the other day. Not a question, but I heard in your podcast the part about Ole Miss. We'd be in new territory. My apologies. With the committee assessing the team without its head coach, this isn't completely new. When Brian Kelly left for LSU, the committee opined Notre Dame with Marcus Freeman provided sufficient continuity, they could rule otherwise. And I wanted to add that there was some reporting today from On3's Chris Lowe. Here was a quote that he got from a former playoff committee member. If you're suddenly without your head coach when they do the final seeding, the coach who's gotten you to that point, then they could definitely drop you in the seeding order and put you on the road. If Ole Miss is 11-1, Lane Kiffin not being there isn't going to keep them out of the playoff. That's not going to happen. But the seeding part could be a problem if it's close. So I don't know if you have any other things to add there, Eric. But
that's a great piece of information. I want to tell Jeff thank you, because when I saw the question, it did remind me of that. But I also think what the committee member said is a good posture, because if you think about how that bowl game went, Notre Dame didn't go into the playoff. They played in the bowl game against the Oklahoma State. It was a difference. Not so much that Marcus Freeman, but who replaced Marcus Freeman as defensive coordinator. That was problematic in that game. The defensive coordinator was Mike Elston in that game, and that didn't go well. And I have a lot of respect for Mike Elston. It was just – maybe he was pressing too hard in that game to make a good impression or whatever, but it didn't work. So that the committee might have said, well, you know, we thought the continuity was a big deal, and yet that, you know, that was a little bit problematic in that game.
All right. Next, we have a series of questions from LDL Go Iris on the loose emoji board that I tried to condense a bit. First, we have Christian Gray look good in his return. When will other injured players return?
So we're talking about Jaden Greathouse was not on the injury list today, and Marcus Freeman on the Thursday update. And Marcus Freeman said he is available. They would like to redshirt him if they get into a bind in these next two games where they need him. He said he'd play and he'd be happy to play and happy to help the team. So he's going to be ready. He's practicing and he's cleared. But we will likely see him in the playoff opener if Notre Dame makes the playoff. The other guys on the out for the game list are Noah Burnett, the kicker, Cooper Flanagan, the tight end, Charles Jagaza and Peter Jones, offensive lineman, Gabe Rubio, defensive lineman, Billy Shrouth, offensive lineman, and Sean Savolano, defensive lineman. So let's look at the key guys there. Noah Burnett, in talking to Marty Biagi, they feel like he might be back for the playoff. If he is, he would have a chance to compete to be the number one kicker again. Cooper Flanagan, I don't think he comes back before the playoff. He came back with the Achilles from the Achilles injury in October. I think if he comes back, he would come back in the playoff. Jagaza, I'd flip a coin on whether he comes back in the playoff. Peter Jones is a deep reserve. I don't think they would push him. Gabe Rubio, I think, will be back. I think they're optimistic he'll be back for the playoff. Same with Billy Shrouth. And Sean Savolano is a deeper reserve, so there wouldn't be a push for him. You want to add to that, Tyler?
I don't know that you missed anything. I don't have like keen insight on any of these injuries. I'm certainly fascinated by what happens with Burnett if and when healthy. And I'm curious, like, how much of that it has to do with the success or lack of success Eric Schmidt has in the last two games of the regular season, because I imagine that might play a role too. But
one thing I should say about I'll say this about the kicking situation too. And I think that LDL asked about the kicking situation that's specific. I asked Marty Biagi on Tuesday night, you know, Justin Yoon comes walking in the door, easy peasy to be a freshman kicker. Jonathan Dorr walks in the door and it's paralyzingly difficult for a couple of years. And then he turns into one of the most accurate Notre Dame kickers that they've had. And I asked him what the variable is in that. And a lot of it is mechanics, what a kid is doing in high school and speeding up the operation time and kicking off a tee versus not kicking off a tee. And there's all kinds of different factors. And Eric Schmidt had more of those factors than a Justin Yoon did. And the plan was to redshirt him. They feel like this guy has a world of potential, but the plan going in was let's try to redshirt him. And then he was just too good in kickoffs to redshirt. So they thought, well, let's not have him do place kicks into next year. And then Noah Burnett had injury issues and they've kind of pushed him in there, but they've tested the mental part of this and they feel like it's not a mental block, that this really is fundamentals that can be corrected. And so I think that's the hope, that Eric Schmidt continues to get better, that it's not a nerves thing, that it's really a fundamental kind of thing. And they're working on that. So that's my take on the kicking part of this.
Yeah, that was one of the questions from LDO, was what can we hope for and expect in the kicking game going forward? And to me, it's anyone's guess. I don't know that we have any idea what to truly expect. I don't have the highest of hopes, but Notre Dame is doing everything it can to try to figure that out. The other question we had from LDO Go Irish is, do you agree? And this ignored some of the statements he made in his post. Do you agree that tight end depth is improving for Notre Dame? Where else has depth improved as demonstrated by improved play?
Well, I think James Flanagan and Tyler wrote about this earlier in the week. I think it's a real key development that James Flanagan is playing and playing well. Now, I think he has to miss one of these last two games to redshirt, and then he can play throughout the playoffs. So they have to pick which game they want to use him in. But yeah, I think that's really helpful for him to be there. And then if James or the other Flanagan, Cooper Flanagan, who spells his name differently and who's unrelated, it's going to be really confusing when Richie Flanagan gets here next year, who is related but doesn't play tight end.
Well, fortunately, he's a 2027 kid, so we got an extra year to wait.
Okay, we got an extra year. Maybe Cooper Flanagan will be gone. Unless he redshirts, then they'll all be there. But I do think that the depth is better at tight end, and that gives them more flexibility and some play calls too. Other positions, they've been pretty good with depth, but when we look at this injury list that you started with, LDL, in terms of getting some of those guys back, wow, if you got Charles Jagaza and Billy Shrouth both back, that improves your offensive line prowess and your depth. And then getting Gabe Rubio back on the defensive line certainly improves your prowess and depth there as well. I think the other positions have been pretty deep. And just getting healthy guys back like Devontae Smith and, as you mentioned, Christian Gray. I mean, so they've been pretty solid at the other positions.
Yeah, the issue I have with the tight end depth is that, yes, James Flanagan is improving, but he's filling the void of Cooper Flanagan rather than complimenting him right now. So until and unless they get both of them able to play at the same time, then I don't know that, like, your on-field depth has necessarily improved. But obviously, for the most of the season, Cooper Flanagan wasn't available either, so the hope was that he would be back, and we'll see what happens moving forward with that. But yeah, I do think it's a good thing that James Flanagan is showing what he can do and building trust in the coaching staff and his ability to do that. The position that to me stands out as one that has proven its depth because of the injuries this season was defensive tackle. Like, I'm not sure that I fully believed that the defensive tackle depth would be able to handle the loss of Gabriel Rubio for this long. But I don't know that you've noticed the difference, right? I mean, not that Gabriel Rubio is not a good player, but I think Notre Dame's been perfectly fine without him. And even Donovan Heinisch missing a game recently too. So I think defensive tackle is the one position that I feel like the guys stepping up to prove that there is depth at the position have really been impressive to me. All right, our last question is from Marie Biafore. One more Pat Narduzzi thought. Why do you think Pat Narduzzi is always so crabby?
Let's get Dr. Laura on the phone. That's above my pay grade to figure that out.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he likes to poke the bear and enjoys all the chaos that comes around with him. I think more than anything, he lacks a filter. I think he says a lot of things that maybe some people think, but would not say as a head coach of a college football program.
The irony is, I think he said he was a psychology major
in college. well, maybe that's getting to Andy Betts's conspiracy theory. He was trying to get into the psychology of the CFP committee by getting him to question whether or not they were trying.
Well, he's going to have to bring bourbon to those committee meetings then if they're going to take him seriously.
All right. That'll be it for this week's episode of the Third and Gold Podcast. You can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other podcast homes. Search for Notre Dame Football with Eric Hansen and Tyler James if you're not already subscribed to us on the proper feeds. We have plenty of written content over at blueandgold.com to get you ready for the Syracuse game. So stick with Blue and Gold for all your Notre Dame coverage needs.